The Honorable, the judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit is now in session. All persons having business before this honorable court may now draw near, and they shall be heard. God save the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Thank you, everyone. Please be seated. For those of you from out of St. Louis, welcome to St. Louis. For those of you in the building that may also be from St. Louis, welcome to the Eagleton Courthouse. It's always good to see a nice turnout. As you know, that practice regularly before circuit courts, we don't oftentimes have standing room only in three or four different locations throughout the building, and we're at it here. So we're delighted to have you. By prior arrangement, as I understand, Mr. Clement, you are going to take a half hour of your allotted time. You can divide it any way you have, as I understand from the clerk's office. You're going to take 25 minutes and then save 5 minutes for rebuttal. And Mr. Olson, you'll have 30 minutes straight across the board in between.
Thank you.
All right. We'll hear first from Mr. Clement.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. The district court order under review here suffers from three independent legal defects. First, and most obviously, the preliminary injunction runs afoul of the clear terms of the Norris LaGuardia Act. That act is broadly written and clearly encompasses this dispute and does not require the presence of a labor union. Second, and equally important, this dispute is covered by the non-statutory labor exemption. And, of course, that's not a great surprise because the non-statutory labor exemption itself is an implied antitrust immunity based on several labor statutes, including the Norris LaGuardia Act. And third and finally, the order under review violates the doctrine of primary jurisdiction, both because this case satisfies all the preconditions for primary jurisdiction, but perhaps even more clearly, because the Supreme Court's Brown decision cautioned the courts against a finding that the non-statutory labor exemption was inapplicable without seeking the detailed views of the board. But that's what happened here. Now, the district court, of course, thought all three of these legal obstacles vanished upon the union's unilateral disclaimer. That is not and cannot be the law. Instead, the Norris LaGuardia Act, by its plain terms, continues to apply here, even if the disclaimer were held to be valid, because by its plain terms, the Norris LaGuardia Act requires a labor dispute between, among others, a group of employers and a group of employees, but nothing in the text of the Norris LaGuardia Act requires the presence of a union, which, of course, makes perfect sense, because one of the things that the Norris LaGuardia Act was clearly designed to protect was the ability of employees who were not yet a union to unionize. So there's nothing in the text of the act that suggests that the presence of a union is required. Now, if any further clarity on that score were necessary, if there were any doubt, and I would submit the text admits of none, but that doubt is completely eliminated by the Supreme Court's decision in the new Negro Alliance case, where they made clear that the Norris LaGuardia Act applied to an effort to deal with an employer on terms and conditions of employment, even by an entity that was clearly not a labor union. And indeed, it's not just the holding that's relevant, it's the reasoning that's relevant. The Supreme Court in that decision, first of all, was confronted in the briefs with a specific argument that all of the cases that the New Negro Alliance relied on were distinguishable because all of them involved unions. That was in the briefing. The Supreme Court was not persuaded by that argument. What they were persuaded by was the text and structure of the Norris LaGuardia Act. And what they specifically held is that if you look at the Norris LaGuardia Act, there are definitions that include a union, there are definitions that include disputes between employers and employees, and yet there are broader terms in the Act. And the court said that not only do those broader terms capture the New Negro Alliance, but they suggest that this Congress was not intent on limiting the scope of the term labor dispute. So for that reason, this case clearly comes within the purposefully capacious term labor dispute.
Does it forever grow out of a labor dispute?
Well, I would say that the answer to that is probably not. It doesn't forever.
When does it end?
Well, it depends what we're talking about. I would suggest that if what you're talking about is a lockout in particular, that that's something where there may not be a need for a court to find what the endpoint is as to a lockout. And the reason I say that is twofold. One is, I think there's economic self-interest will take care of this, which is to say a lockout, by its nature, doesn't really make any economic sense unless it's designed to be a labor law tool to get people to reach a collective bargaining
agreement. You think it lasts a year?
I think it lasts at least a year, Your Honor.
Huh. Now, you agreed to 6 months once upon a time. Why not 6 months, September 11?
Well, I think 6 months, as was obviously in the contractual agreement here, but I think that all that suggests is that's the absolute bare minimum. Both sides agreed in that very different context, assuming that the labor agreement would run its course, the collective bargaining agreement would run its course upon expiration, that no suit could be brought for at least 6 months. So by my way of reckoning, that's not the outer limit. That's the absolute minimum, because even the union was willing to agree to that time period. I would think if you're looking for a time period, the least that you would have would be one business cycle. And in this context of this league, that would be at least a year. But as I say, as to lockouts in particular, I think there are two reasons to not worry too much about what the end point is. The one, as I've already suggested, is that for a multi-employer bargaining unit or for an individual employer, I mean, locking out your employees if there's no prospect of getting a negotiated agreement with the union is essentially a self-inflicted wound. You wouldn't do it unless you thought that it was progressing towards an end of a solution. The second reason, if I just get it on the table, is that in the context of a lockout in particular, I think there's a strong argument that the lockout would be covered not just by the non-statutory labor exemption, but by the statutory exemption in Section 20 of the Clayton Act, because that provision by its terms applies to tactics like lockouts, and that statutory exemption doesn't have an endpoint, and there's no reason, I think, to infer or impose a judicially created endpoint on that. But I say, I mean, even if you don't want to go with me that far, I think certainly at a bare minimum, this would continue to grow out of a labor dispute, at least for, at a bare minimum, one business cycle, which in this context would be a year. We think it would last longer.
You didn't agree to one business cycle. You agreed to 6 months.
But that was in a very different context, Your Honor. That was in the context
the
where
the CBA we're talking about here, right?
If it ran its course, we agreed that no antitrust suit would be brought for at least 6 months. That didn't mean that we couldn't argue that after 6 months, the non-statutory labor exemption applied. That certainly didn't mean that the Norris-LaGuardia Act would only apply for 6 months. There's no suggestion that there's some sort of special limit on the Norris-LaGuardia Act and its prohibition against injunctions in labor disputes, which by its terms is absolute.
So you think the two are not coextensive, the non-statutory exemption and Norris LaGuardia?
I don't think they need to be coextensive, which is to say I think that, I mean, you know, there's a reason. We think, obviously, that both continue to be applicable here. And we think there are reasons why they would often be coextensive, because, as I said, there are places in which the Supreme Court has made clear that one of the labor statutes that the non-statutory labor exemption is based on is the Norris-LaGuardia Act. But that said, we also know from some of the Supreme Court's own cases that they don't necessarily have to be completely coextensive.
What's your position? Are they coextensive or not? The district court thought they were coextensive, I think, by the way the district court addressed them.
And I would say that they are not coextensive, but they are both applicable here. But as to the proposition—
Did the district court really think that? I thought the district court said it wasn't even deciding whether the exemption continued, but it thought Norris LaGuardia did not apply, even though the exemption might apply.
Well, there are a couple of different—
Except as to lockouts.
Right, exactly. As to lockouts, the way I read the district court's opinion, and I think the majority of the panel read the district court's decision this way in the stay order, she holds that as to lockouts, they're just not covered by the non-statutory labor exemption. Full stop.
Ever.
Not a matter of timing. You know, I don't know if that part of her decision turned on the presence or absence of the union. I don't think it even did. I just think she held, as a matter of law, that lockouts are covered by the non-statutory labor exemption. And I would submit the only way in which that could possibly be right is if you held that, in fact, lockouts are covered by the statutory labor exemption in Section 20, and therefore wasn't even necessary for the non-statutory labor exemption to reach them. But in all events, you know, the Supreme Court heard essentially the converse argument in the Brown case. It heard the argument, well, tactics, those are covered, but terms, imposition of terms, that's not covered by the non-statutory labor exemption. And the Supreme Court made short work of that argument in the Brown case by saying, well, wait a minute, the imposition of terms is itself a tactic. So it'd be kind of incoherent to distinguish between tactics and terms in those kind of ways. And I think whatever else is true, the district court's reasoning on that point, that the non-statutory labor exemption does not reach tactics at all, is clearly erroneous. Now, with respect to sort of the broader point there, which is the district court's sort of suggesting in other places that you didn't have to definitively decide whether or not the non-statutory labor exemption was applicable, I do think that was an error. I do think the non-statutory labor exemption, by its terms, clearly applies here. And I also think that Brown teaches that before a court can allow an antitrust suit to go forward, can allow certainly an injunction to go forward, if there's any concern about the outer boundaries of the non-statutory labor exemption, that's an issue where, in the Supreme Court's terms, the court should get the benefit of the detailed views of the board. So I think it was a mistake for the district court to reach an adverse decision on the non-statutory labor exemption in the context of this case. I do think, as I said at the outset, though, that when you look at this case, the clearest and first obstacle is, of course, the Norris LaGuardia Act. The second obstacle that is, I think, equally obvious is the non-statutory labor exemption. And with respect to the non-statutory labor exemption, the players are, you know, like to point to the statement in the Supreme Court's Brown decision that the non-statutory labor exemption might expire upon decertification. Now, there's two things I think that are very important about that point. One is that while the D.C. Circuit said that it might well expire at decertification, the Supreme Court went out of its way not to make that its holding. It referenced that as a possible outer boundary, but then specifically said before a court should definitively define whether the outer boundaries are and what the limits of the outer boundaries are, you should get the detailed views of the labor board.
You're talking about the Supreme Court opinion now?
Yeah, I'm talking about the Supreme Court opinion.
What do you think
Brown?
They meant by these extreme boundaries? Isn't that referring back to some boundary previously mentioned?
Sure. And what they said is before any court says that those are the extreme outer boundaries, you should get the detailed views of the labor board.
Well, it says where within these boundaries.
Whether or within. I mean, I can grab
Yeah, whether or within these extreme boundaries. Doesn't that mean there are extreme boundaries identified and then whether there should be a line within those?
Oh, with respect, I read it very differently. I say whether or within means whether at all those are the appropriate outer boundaries, and then within those appropriate boundaries, where do you draw the line? I view that all right. as all a very clear direction that it's one thing to say the non-statutory labor exemption applies without getting the board's detailed views. That's what the Supreme Court itself did in the Brown decision. But before you go further and say, as the D.C. Circuit perhaps did, that decertification is the line, you need to get the detailed views of the board.
What would the board likely tell us about that?
Well,
they might tell us whether this is an unfair labor practice to disclaim, but
indeed.
Would they tell us anything beyond that, in your view, about the exemption?
They might. They might actually offer the court some insights as to whether or not the labor laws need some breathing room in order to accommodate the labor law policies. I think they also might tell you whether or not, you know, one of the ironies here is the players in their brief want to emphasize that, you know, if the union really is gone forever, which we very much doubt, but if the union's really gone forever, then sort of continuing to try to negotiate with them as a union is itself a violation of Section 7 of the labor laws, of the Wagner Act. Now, if that's true, I mean, that's also something that the board could opine on. So there are all sorts of ways in which the labor law continues to apply to this and that the board's view could certainly inform what a court were to say about the outer boundaries of the non-statutory labor exemption. But let me be clear about one other thing, which is the language there is talking about decertification. And there's this sort of sense, I think, you would get from the player's brief that decertification and disclaimer are synonyms or they're fungible somehow. And that's absolutely not the case. There are two critical differences between decertification and disclaimer. The first is that with respect to decertification, that's a process that the board itself oversees. So if you have a valid decertification, you know that the board is, if you will, on board with the decertification because they will have overseen the whole process. The second critical difference is that decertification carries with it the consequence that the union cannot reappear or resurrect itself for a full year. And so in that sense, decertification is a much more definitive step than disclaimer, because I think as far as both past history would teach us, but also You know, there's no suggestion that a unilateral disclaimer imposes any disability on the union to reappear in some relatively short time period if it serves their interests. And I think, again, any student of this particular industry, any student of the history of this industry, any student of statements that have been made by the players in the context of this has serious, serious doubts that the union is gone forever.
Could a union reappear within a year after decertification if the employer recognizes the union?
I think it could, Your Honor. I think, which is to say, I think the bar on reappearing is something that probably is waivable.
So there could be a decertification, and if that caused the exemption to end, and then there was a settlement, like the White settlement, the union could reappear in short order.
Only not as a matter of right, not as a matter of unilateral right.
Matter of agreement.
As a matter of agreement, perhaps, but there's, I think, a very important difference between a union decertifying, which basically says that unless they get sort of consent, they're gone for a year, and a union that disclaims, in which case they can pop back into existence whenever it's convenient. And I think that has real consequences for the purpose of this case, which is if you think, even if you thought that the disclaimer was valid, but you thought that the union might well pop back up and ultimately reach a settlement in this case, which I think is the only realistic assumption. But if you thought that, then there's no material difference between a unilateral disclaimer and the impasse situation that the court was confronting in Brown. There's the same basic problem, which is if you're a multi-employer bargaining association and you think that the union may well reappear and you may well be in a position to reach a collective bargaining agreement with them, I mean, what are you supposed to do? Are you supposed to disband immediately and no longer be a multi-employer bargaining association? Or can you do what the labor laws tell you you clearly can do?
But how would decertification be any different? Wouldn't you have the same problem because the union can reappear in the settlement agreement?
I don't think you do, Your Honor, because I think that's a much more definitive step. It's board certified. So there's, in that sense, you have the assurance that the board itself is overseeing the process and essentially makes it a real disclaimer or a real, you know, end of the union. And then you have a full year where, absent some kind of agreement, you can't have the union reappear. And I think that itself, I think, would have important impacts on the bargaining relationship. I mean, I think there's a reason that this is a disclaimer and not a decertification. I think if you're a union and you decertify, even though there's a possibility that with consent you can pop back up, that hurts you in the bargaining process. That's giving a tool to the other side in the bargaining process. And that's not something that is the case when you have a disclaimer. In a unilateral disclaimer, you can pop back up at your own initiative and your own motion whenever. And what's going on here is quite clear. In fact, you only have to read the complaint. The complaint doesn't hide this fact. They've disclaimed in order to pursue an antitrust remedy. To use the terms of this court in the Powell case, they want to get that antitrust lever. And what this court said in the Powell case, the dissent said, hey, this is horrible. You're taking away the player's antitrust lever. And what the majority in Powell said is, exactly. That's what the non-statutory labor exemption does. That's what the Norris LaGuardia Act does even more clearly. It says collective bargaining. This is about the terms and conditions of employment. This is going to be resolved ultimately by collective bargaining. This court, every time it's had one of these cases, has made the point, even starting back in Mackey, that ultimately collective bargaining is a much better way to resolve these disputes than antitrust litigation.
Well, they've disclaimed twice, right?
They have disclaimed twice, right. Which ought to be a problem for them.
Well, ignore that. They've disclaimed twice. How long does a non-statutory exemption last? Does it last a business cycle? Is that your position, a year? Or is it 6 months, like your previous agreement?
I think it lasts at least a year, Your Honor, and I would say with respect to the lockout, it lasts even longer. And if you think about it, I mean, think about the situation where you're talking about terms of employment. I mean, one of the reasons why the non-statutory labor exemption has to continue for at least a business cycle, and I would suggest probably even longer, is otherwise the agreements you reached during the collective bargaining process, the agreement process that went on there, the otherwise impermissible discussions among otherwise competitors, all that is fair game for allegations in the antitrust suit. And if there's any unit of time after the disclaimer where it's still appropriate for the multi-employer bargaining unit to be continuing to have their own discussions, all of that is going to be fair game for an antitrust suit. And you would expect that, you know, there are going to be continuing effects of the collective bargaining process and those agreements for a considerable period of time. Every industry might be a little bit different about how those processes work out, but you need to give effective breathing space to the collective bargaining process. You know, I think what the court recognized in the Brown case, I think it recognized in a different context in the Credit Suisse case, Credit Suisse against Billing case, is that when you have regulatory regimes that are very antithetical to the antitrust laws because they take employers, they take would-be competitors and say, you know what, you can get together and you can talk about common conditions, terms and conditions, whether it's the labor context or it's the joint underwriting context, when a regulatory regime tells would-be competitors that they can get together, it's not something where you can just flip a switch and say, well, and if you cross a regulatory line or the second there's an impasse or the second there's a unilateral disclaimer, boom, you're in the antitrust world.
You agree it has to end sometime?
I agree it has to end sometime. Let me be clear what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Non-statutory labor exemption,
right.
as to terms, has to end sometime.
Yeah.
Now, I think two things are important. Don't think that obviously applies to the Norris LaGuardia Act context. I think you can just say that antitrust injunctions are a problem.
There's no proximate limit on growth.
No.
The Norris LaGuardia Act.
Yes, but again,
never approximate limit.
But again, that's different from saying there's no limit in the non-statutory labor exemption context, because what's covered by the Norris LaGuardia Act? There are certain things we would certainly submit, including lockouts, that you can't have an injunction about. But otherwise, the Norris LaGuardia Act allows certain other kinds of injunctions, and that's what it covers. The non-statutory labor exemption has a broader coverage. It doesn't just cover injunctions, it covers liability as well. And I would certainly think when you're talking about terms, in order to reconcile the Supreme Court's own teaching that at some point in a non-unionized industry, a joint imposition of terms is an antitrust problem, you have to have some outer point where that dissipates. Now, I'm not sure the same thing applies to a lockout. And the reason I say that is because of the text of Section 20 of the Clayton Act and the reality that unlike the imposition of terms, which is always going to be a very tempting thing for a joint employer group, a group of joint employers or a single employer, are not going to want to lock out their employees unless they think it's going to facilitate the resolution of a labor dispute. It's suicide otherwise. I mean, if the NFL owners don't think that we are ultimately going to get a resolution of this, they're not going to not put out a product. They're not going to have a lockout. It doesn't make sense. The reason the lockout makes sense is because this continues to be, as defined by the Norris LaGuardia Act, a labor dispute. It can be resolved by terms of a collective bargaining agreement. I'd be willing to bet that in their heart of hearts, everybody, almost everybody in this room, assumes that's what's going to happen, that this is ultimately going to be resolved, and it's part of the resolution is ultimately going to include a collective bargaining agreement. And if that's the case, it makes no sense to say that right now the league is in a position where they can't use one of the classic tools that labor law gives them to get to a settlement. You know, I think everybody understands that we want to get players back on the field, coaches back on the field. Well, how do you get that to happen? I think both common sense and the law in this area provide the answer. And the answer is that you get extraneous considerations like antitrust actions and antitrust injunctions out of the process, and you let both sides use their labor law tools to resolve the dispute. That's the best way to resolve the dispute. Now, the second thing I want to just add is that I think it's important to recognize that one of the premises of the idea that if you get the situation where the labor union disappears, that it doesn't make any sense to continue to have the Norris LaGuardia Act apply because labor law no longer protects the employees. And with respect, that's wrong. Non-unionized workers have a right to strike. Non-unionized workers have a Section 7 right to be bargained with outside the union. So the labor laws are not laws that are limited to the presence of a union. You can look at the Victani case from the Sixth Circuit that's directly on point on this. We cite it in our reply brief. But it is just, it's a mistake to think that labor laws require the presence of a union. They don't. And in the same way, the Norris LaGuardia Act, Section 20 of the Clayton Act, they don't require the presence of a union to be applicable.
What do you say to the Norris LaGuardia argument that the literal definition would go so far as to cover all of these individual employment contract disputes that are cited? What's the limiting principle on that?
Well,
I
think it is an incredibly broad definition. And I think what those cases show is that the definition is so broad that when you're trying to reconcile the Norris LaGuardia Act with subsequently passed statutes that provide, you know, sort of employment rights for individual employees, that you essentially have to read the two statutes in a way to make sense of the two statutes. Now, some statutes, the ADA, Title VII, have expressly carved out the Norris LaGuardia Act. So Congress sort of was conscious of the problem, and they carved it out. But in other contexts, I think the courts have recognized that with later enacted statutes, when you're dealing with individual employees, often in the context of a reinstatement process, you need to essentially make the later enacted statute work with the earlier enacted statute. But that is not something you need to do when it comes to an antitrust claim. This wolf comes as a wolf. This is exactly the kind of claim that the Norris LaGuardia Act was directed at. The best evidence of that is, of course, Section 5, which makes clear that antitrust claims uniquely were the concern that prompted the passage of the Norris LaGuardia Act. In that context, there's no reason to reconcile. Most of the cases they rely on, frankly, are either employment disputes or their Section 301 claims under the LMRA.
Well, they have some reasoning about whether 4A, for example, applies to employers at all.
They do, but that reasoning, I think, is way too broad. I think that's, and I think most of them, these are relatively old cases. I think that was when sort of a different view of legislative history held sway. And I think those cases, the best case they have is probably the D'Arroyo case from the First Circuit. And that case starts its analysis with the premise that the employers are right based on the literal text of the statute, and then goes on to say why, in a different context, not a lockout context, but in a different context of reinstating an employee under the LMRA, that you get to a different result. Now, I'd like to think that the literal text ought to be sort of a stopping point, not a starting point. But in any event, I think you only have to look at the Supreme Court's Boys Markets case to know that it's different when it's the LMRA. There's a recognition by the Supreme Court you need to reconcile that later enacted statute. But that's not the case when it comes to the antitrust laws. If I may reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Clint. We'll now hear from Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'd like to start with the footnote of this Court, number 12, in the Powell case. That footnote says, the League concedes that the Sherman Act could be found applicable if the affected employees ceased to be represented by a certified union. The same point was made by Judge Edwards in the Brown case in the D.C. Circuit, where he made the point that, in our view, the non-statutory labor exemption requires the union or the employees to choose to be represented by a union, or if they choose not to be represented by a union, they are protected by the antitrust laws. It's a binary choice. They have one or the other. Now, in the Brown case, the League, in its briefs, when that case got to the Supreme Court, in its briefs acknowledged the same thing that it did earlier before this Court in the Powell case, that if the union was dissolved, if there was no longer a union, the antitrust laws applied. In fact, counsel for the League was asked about this during the argument in the United States Supreme Court. Basically, he said, well, then do you agree with Judge Edwards? And there was a colloquy, and of course, at the end of that colloquy, which is cited in the briefs, he said, yes, we do.
Although he has his caveat for tactical. Doesn't he have a caveat for tactical disclaimers?
Well,
he
sort of has that caveat, but that is precluded, it seems to me, by the fact that Judge Edwards, going back to the D.C. Circuit again, specifically said the deunionization, the decision by the employees not to be a part of the union, was exactly what we note that the NFL players took exactly this latter step after the Eighth Circuit's Powell decision. In other words, Judge Edwards was saying there, and the league's lawyers were completely aware of this when they got at the time and when they got to the Supreme Court, that's what happened before in the Eighth Circuit. So if you take what happened in the Eighth Circuit in the Powell decision and then what happened after that, and then look at what Judge Doty was talking about when the case came back before him, he then describes in detail, this is at 764 F sup, exactly what the league did to become not a part of a union, what the employees did, the players did, not to become part of a union. And what they did then is exactly what they have done now. They filed the they had an election by the players, which happened, as you indicated, Judge Benton, twice here. The players agreed all across, all 32 teams, they did not want to be in a union anymore. They filed the appropriate forms with the IRS, switching from a C5 union organization to a C6 business league. That's what the Players Association did. And in other words, did every step necessary to become not a union anymore. They made a significant choice, which has significant effects under the labor laws, and they did it the way that was outlined for them in the Powell decision, in the Brown decision, and this court in the White case specifically refers to the fact, again, that when that happened before, and there was a period during 1989 to 1993 when the union did not exist. And the parties ultimately came together, and who wanted the union to be reformed? The league wanted the union to be reformed, because unlike other industries, this is not a situation where the players are at advantage by being in a union. So what the league did is insisted, and this is mentioned specifically in your decision in the White case, the league insisted, I think that's the word in the case itself, that the players reformulate themselves into a union. Now, this is a light switch on and off. That takes a vote of the players. It takes a significant period of time. And in one of the decisions, the courts in this circuit outline the number of steps that it takes and the number of procedures that it takes. It took over a several month period of time, 3-4 months period of time. It is not an on and off switch. And it's not something that the players are going to want to do. The players are perfectly happy to be protected by the antitrust laws, which the laws of the United States give them that choice. If they wish to be protected by the benefits of unionization, they can do that.
Counsel, if I understand your argument right now, it really goes to the non-statutory exemption. But focus with me for a second on the Norris-LaGuardia Act, and you rely principally on Section 2.
Well, we rely on Section 2.
Play along with me for
okay,
a second. Sure. I understand. I understand all your other arguments. But in Section 2, at the very end of it, it says, for the purpose of collective bargaining or other mutual aid or protection. So collective bargaining is not necessarily required for the Norris-LaGuardia Act to apply. Other mutual aid or protection, an established term in labor law, is possible. So doesn't that make the district court completely wrong in saying there has to be a union as a precondition for the Norris-LaGuardia Act to apply?
I think not. I think that there are certain circumstances under Norris-LaGuardia Act where certain of the provisions apply irrespective of that. The right not to join a union, it's specifically talked about in Section 2. Also, it's specifically talked about in Section 7, and the Supreme Court has said it would be the greatest thing of anti-labor law to force people to be a part of a union. So, yes, the answer is that under certain circumstances, a union is not necessary. Employers have a right not to be an employer organization and so forth. In fact, when we talk about the Norris-LaGuardia Act, the fact is quite clear. Mr. Clement refers to these as old cases. He relies on the New Negro Alliance case, which is a lot older than the cases that we've been citing. But with respect to Section 4A,
Well, all right, go ahead.
I'll be happy to answer.
Well, no, go ahead, but I think we should talk about whether it's a labor dispute at all as well. But go ahead.
I would like to talk about that, but I think that the court indicated some, two of you indicated some skepticism about that in your stay opinion, and I wanted to say that irrespective of that, Section 4A does not put this lockout in the anti-injunction, no injunction zone. Section 4A, which is the section that the league relies upon, there are three circuits that have explicitly, over three decades, the First Circuit, the Seventh Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit. That's the locomotive workers case in the Seventh Circuit, the D'Arroyo case, which Mr. Clement mentioned in the First Circuit, and the lumber and sawmill workers versus coal in the Ninth Circuit, 1962, 1970, and 1980, three decisions where the courts in each of those cases was absolutely explicit that Section 4A has no intention to preclude injunctions against employers, and it points out that where employers were intended to be covered in Section 3B or in Section 4B, the statute refers to them. It does not refer to them in Section 4A.
So that would mean they're not covered by 4C, D, E, F, G, H, or I as well.
Well, right? there are some disputes with respect to 4C, which is a provision that the league is not relying on.
Well, I know,
apply
but
in
I'm
this
just
case.
Wondering if it would be coherent for us to say it the 4C under our case law protects employers, but 4A doesn't because the D'Arroyo rationale says unless they're mentioned in B, they're not covered in A. How can we have them covered in C and not in A?
Well, I think that there are some court decisions that talk about 4C because it has to do with strike insurance and insurance and things of that nature and payments. That's, of course, not the case here. But 4A was specifically intended, according to the three circuits who have decided it, that would be a split with those circuits if this court were to decide otherwise, that it was not intended to protect employers, it was not intended to preclude injunctions in cases against employers, and it was intended to protect the right to strike. Those three courts all went back to the history of the Clayton Act, Section 20. Justice Frankfurter, who was the author of the Norris-LaGuardia Act, who wrote that in his treatise about the labor injunction, and then specifically said the same thing as a Supreme Court justice in the Hutchison case. And the language of the statute makes it relatively clear that it would apply to strikes, 4A would apply to strikes and not to something like a lockout. The league relies on the refuse to remain in a relation of employment. That is not what's going on here. In the first place, all of the literature, the legislative history, and we cite the exact language in the Senate report and the House report in connection with Clayton Act Section 20, which 4A is intended to parrot as it came along, specifically talked in terms of strikes. It was intended to protect those individuals who went on strike or those individuals who wanted to quit and terminate their relationship with their employer. That was
or
the
any
latter.
Other relationship. You left the word any out when you summarized the statute.
Oh.
I'm sure unintentionally, but anyway, right? The word any is the freight there. You agree?
Well, the word is in there, but the historical context and the language of the three circuits that I referred to make it clear that it was talking about striking or quitting.
Why is that clear from the history? Judge Coffin says that. There's no citation. Why is it that refuse to remain in relation couldn't apply to a strike?
Well,
under the law at the time.
Because the employment relationship continues. And let me use this case as an example. There are three categories of players that we're talking about. Those that are under contract, which the league insists are still employees. They're sending notices, and this is in the briefs. I'm not going outside the briefs, saying you must comply with the conduct provisions. You must be ready to sign up. You must be this, that, and the other thing. And they are not saying, all these people are free agents now. I invite Mr. Clement to say, when he gets up here, to say that all of those players are now free agents because they're not in a relation of employment. But there's also existing free agents, so there's no refusal to remain in a relationship of employment with them. And there are the rookies, the people that are draftees, the potential employees, potential players who are not in any relation of employment with the league. So,
what do you understand the district court's order to require with respect to rookies and free agents?
Well, the district, as I understand the district court's decision, it said the lockout, that is to say the group boycott, the refusal to deal, must end because it's a violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act. I might say that the league is very familiar with the antitrust laws. I counted 15 cases in which the league has either been held by courts of appeals in the D.C. Circuit, the First Circuit, the Ninth Circuit, the Second Circuit, and this circuit to be in violation of the antitrust laws, plus two Supreme Court decisions, one 12 months ago, unanimous decision of the Supreme Court. So the league is very familiar with the antitrust laws, and the league desperately wants these employees to be a part of a union so that they can continue to violate the antitrust laws. They are violating the antitrust laws. They did not even dispute that this is a per se violation of the antitrust laws, the group boycott that's going on now. But they have a right, they say, to do it because they're protected by the labor exemption and they're entitled to be free from an injunction under the Norris LaGuardia
Act. Do you agree those are separate issues?
Yes, I do agree
you
that
you don't think the two are coextensive.
I think there is a certain degree of overlap.
Right, but you can have a prohibition on injunction even when there is potential liability under the Sherman Act. Do you agree with that?
Yes, Section 7 specifically talks about that. There may be, if it is Section 4A is not applicable, which it is not in this case, according to the legislative history, the language of the statute, and the three circuit court opinions that we cited, and the fact that there is no refusal to remain in a relation of employment, any relation of employment.
And you agree that the Norris LaGuardia Act could greatly compound the damages in a later antitrust case.
I assume that's correct.
Of any prohibition on it or any conflict in that way.
I'm not sure I understand the question, but
okay.
I don't see one.
Suppose the Norris LaGuardia Act applies. I'm sorry, I've got it back. Suppose that the Norris LaGuardia Act applies and there can't be an injunction. Okay. But suppose the non-statutory exemption's over for some reason. So the fact that the Norris LaGuardia Act would allow for greatly increasing the damages, perhaps, in a later antitrust case.
I accept that, but I don't believe that there's two parts to the Norris LaGuardia Act. The no injunction zone, which is for Section 4, which we've demonstrated does not apply here. So there may be an injunction. Now, if there may be an injunction, it's an injunction because it satisfies the conditions of Section 7. And I wanted not to forget your question, Judge Colleton, with respect to whether there's a labor dispute.
Well, my concern is this. Let's say you have a situation where there is no union, and you have employees who the situation is flipped. Employees, say, are dissatisfied with working conditions in a shop or a plant, and they say, we're not organized, we're not in a union, but we're going to walk out and protest these bad working conditions. Until the boss cleans it up, we're not coming back. Wouldn't that be a labor dispute, even though they're not?
I think it might be because I would adopt or rely on, is a better word, the decision of this court in the Ozark Airlines case, which I think is binding, which said it must be collective labor activity. That might be, and that would explain the possibility of the New Negro Alliance case where basically the people there were functioning in the equivalent of a labor union. And I think the hypothetical that you just raised is where employees were functioning like a union. They're engaged in collective
mutual
labor
aid,
activity.
As Judge Benton said. The language from the statute about mutual aid would be applicable there, maybe.
It might possibly.
So that would mean the district court was wrong to say there has to be a union, and the position now is there doesn't have to be a union, but there has to be
There has
well,
to be.
What's,
there
how
has
would you
to,
define it?
I think the district court was right in the context of the evolution of what labor dispute meant, and that there can conceivably be functional equivalents like the new Negro Alliance situation, and perhaps under some circumstances. But by and large, the history of the Norris LaGuardia Act, labor dispute had a very fixed meaning. And again, I could turn to Justice Frankfurter, who explained a lot of this.
He wasn't in Congress, was he, at any time, Mr. Olson?
He wasn't in Congress.
But, at my point. We go with the words of the statute.
Oh, yes, but he was the author of the statute. And so while he didn't vote on it, I mean, he was the author of the statute. And the Supreme Court has frequently said that what Justice Frankfurter or Professor Frankfurter may have said with respect to the meaning of the Norris LaGuardia Act is entitled to heavy weight. But it's not just him. It is the language of the two reports, the Senate report and the House report with respect to the Clayton Act, which we've cited, which basically said that it is designed to protect workers who wish to organize.
So would we have to disagree with Judge Winder's opinion in the NBA case then to take that view where there's the discussion about terminating any relation is broad enough to cover lockouts?
I believe that is in. There was not a substantial discussion of 4A in Judge Winter's opinion in that case, and that language was picked up verbatim without considerable discussion. I see that you mentioned this in your stay opinion in the Brown case. That language from Williams was mentioned there. I think that's inconsistent. It's not correctly decided with respect to the extent that it was intended to go that far, but it did not have an extensive discussion of 4A. It did not go into the legislative history or the background or the language. And
well, it was about the Clayton Act, as
right.
I recall. But I think you cite the Frankfurter Green Treatise for the proposition that 4A is just a paraphrase of Section 20. Terminating any relation, remain in any relation.
Yes.
So if the Second Circuit is correct that terminating any relation was broad enough to cover lockouts, then it would seem to follow that the paraphrase is too. But maybe you're saying that was wrong with respect to the Clayton Act
as
well.
I think it is wrong with respect to the Clayton Act. I respectfully submit, because I have great respect for Judge Winter, but I respectfully submit that is true. Also, it is inconsistent with the First, Seventh, and Ninth Circuit cases, which we have cited.
At least his case was about a lockout, though.
Yeah, well,
but I understand your point that the other circuits talk about 4A specifically.
And when we're talking about this particular situation, we are talking about a whole bunch of people, 700-800 people, for which there is no relation of employment at all. So it can't be a refusal to have any relation of employment with them. With respect to the others, and your word any, it's the employer here is deciding that we will not have some relation with the employees, but we will have other relationship. We will take the dessert, but we won't eat the salad. Or maybe even better, we will eat the dinner, but we won't pay the bill. That's sort of what's going on. There is a relationship. There is a relationship of employment that's taking place here.
Counselor, can I ask you something? In the reply brief in footnote 10, the other side says the NLPA continues to pursue a grievance on behalf of over 250 players asserting improper conduct. Is that true or not?
I understand that there is a representation with respect to previous grievances pursuant to a trust arrangement that was set up, which is perfectly permissible under the labor laws, and is not at all consistent, not at all inconsistent with the dissolution of the union.
Is this a trust fund paying their attorney's fees?
I think so, yes.
Thank you.
But none of that is inconsistent with the fact that the union doesn't exist as a matter of law, with the Internal Revenue Service, with the Department of Labor, and consistent with Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act and Section 2 of the Norris LaGuardia Act, the employees have an absolute right not to be in a union. They have chosen not to be in a union. They chose once before not to be in a union. They did the same thing this time, not to be in a union, and they are not in a union. So that union doesn't exist.
Can I ask you one question, Mr. Olson, about the exemption, unless you wanted to talk more about Norris LaGuardia? How do we deal with the fact that the court said at one point that there could be circumstances that are sufficiently distant in time and circumstance
that they wouldn't interfere with the collective bargaining agreement.
Are you referring to the Brown decision?
The Supreme Court decision.
Yes.
And then they said, for example, collapse of the bargaining relationship as evidenced by decertification. Didn't the court seem to contemplate that the collapse would be distant in time and circumstance? Is there a mistake of fact there?
No, I think that it's language, because they were not at all focusing on the deunionization fact at all. They were talking about impasse. When they were talking about distance in time, they were talking about impasse. I think that was...
No, I mean, when they say that we're not insulating these cases from antitrust review at all time because there could be circumstances that are sufficiently distant in time, such as the decertification. Doesn't that seem to contemplate that the decertification would be distant in time and circumstance?
I don't believe so. I think that the first part of that statement referred to how long the impasse might continue. I could be wrong, but I think that's the way I certainly interpreted it when I read it. And particularly,
you mean that there's a lengthy impasse?
Yes. Yes. And
at some point
that would end.
Did we have a lengthy impasse in this case?
No, we don't have a lengthy impasse in this case because the union stopped having a union right then and there. And there is this is Mr. Clement's answers to your question, Judge Benton, as to how long would this last. The union is not in existence anymore. The players cannot engage in collective bargaining because it's against the law. The labor laws, there are maybe some provisions, as Mr. Clement says, that protect certain rights and so forth, but the labor laws do not protect the players from engaging collectively in the process of collective bargaining. It's also against the law for the owners, the league, to engage in collective bargaining with the players. The period of protection by the labor laws is over. Now, the antitrust either kicks in or we have some no man's land where the labor laws aren't protecting the employers and the antitrust laws are not protecting the employers. That can't be the case. It can't be 6 months or maybe a business cycle. What is a business cycle in this business and what is a business cycle in that business? That is a litigation invitation to lawyers throughout the
Council, that's the reason I began with 6 months, because you did all agree on that one time. You ought to be stuck with your deal.
We agreed with it with respect to the circumstances. If the union existed after the end of the collective bargaining agreement, this provision, and then let's talk about the whole provision, because that specifically said, and the White case specifically refers to this, that as a quid pro quo, as a part of the deal, the players agreed to enter into a union, provided that the league, because the players knew what was going on, they knew that the league would want them to be in a union, and they knew that the league would call their decision not to be in a union a sham. So they knew, and they negotiated provision whereby the league waived the right to call it a sham. That's in the very next words of that. Now they're doing it again. When they did it before Judge Doty, they said that the same thing then. It's Groundhog Day here. We're reliving what they did before. When the union did what the courts and the league have said, if you want to be protected by the antitrust laws, this is what you must do. They have done it. They did it before. It was called a sham by the league. Judge Doty looked at all of those factors and said there's no basis in labor law. I think that's his exact words for calling this a sham. Speaking of the NLRB, the general counsel of the NLRB in the Pittsburgh Steelers situation looked at all of the circumstances and basically said, no, that was a valid decision not to be a part of the union. So the NLRB has dealt with those issues. Now, with respect to the primary jurisdiction issue, I think that's another bogus issue. This is a question of law to which the players have an absolute right not to be a part of a union. They did it before. The NLRB said that it was perfectly proper. The district court against the league said it was perfectly proper. They committed that they wouldn't raise this point and that it would be perfectly proper, and yet they're before this court. This is the district court decided with respect to the broadcast arrangements and the contracts with respect to broadcasting that the league was engaged in unconscionable, not to mention unlawful antitrust conduct. I would say that it's verges on unconscionability to claim that this is a fraud or a sham or something like that. The word certification and decertification have been thrown around about a decertification proceeding is not what happens when individuals decide they don't want to be represented by a union anymore, and a union says we disavow the representation of those employees. That's one thing. The union no longer exists. When someone's challenging the right of a union to represent employees, that may be a decertification procedure. But
the union or the employees themselves don't typically seek a decertification through election. That's your point.
That's right. And if some of the employees say, well, this is not a good union, they're not really...
Why would the Supreme Court refer to decertification then? And Judge Edwards, they seem to be talking in the context of a situation where the employees were making the choice, and they were both talking about decertification.
I think the courts and all of us have used the term relatively loosely. It's correct in the sense that the NFLPA is no longer a certified union. They have withdrawn their right to represent, and therefore they're not a certified. The denunciation of the union has the effect of not being a certified union anymore. But it's not a decertification procedure, which is a totally different thing under labor law. In fact, in the casebook, which we cite of the NLRB casebook, it says that if there's a decertification proceeding pending, someone's challenging the right of a union to represent employees, and if the union then disavows its right to represent, then the case will be dismissed because there's no longer any need for the case. It's in the NLRB casebook. So it's important that our terminology be correct here. This is not something that would require a decertification. And by the way, if the union, if the league insisted for in some reason in the future, because the players aren't interested in this, but if the league insisted that the union spring back into existence, it's a significant process. The players for each of the teams would have to be approached. They'd have to vote. Someone else could say, well, you're not the right representative, and so forth. So that is a significant process. There's no question that this is a legitimate decision, and Mr. Clement say, well, that was a tactic to be protected by the antitrust laws. Well, according to Judge Edwards in the Brown case and the Supreme Court and this case, this court on a couple of occasions, it's a decision that has significance that you're entitled to make. If you are a group of employees, you're absolutely protected in the right to make that decision. And I wanted to say one more thing about with respect to the findings under Section 7. We have a situation where the non-statutory labor exemption does not apply. That's not in operation anymore because the union does not exist. And according to the decisions that we've been talking about, that non-statutory labor exemption is out. So if we then turn to the Norris LaGuardia Act, this is not a prohibited injunction under Section 4. It is a permissible injunction if the provisions of Section 7 are met. Now, have the provisions of Section 7 met? We submit that the findings that were made, and this court said that a hearing is not necessary in the Kansas City Southern case if the facts are indisputable.
Yeah, although now, everybody agreed there they were not disputed.
Well, what we have here is that the findings that were made by the district judge, Judge Nelson, here are virtually identical to the same findings that were found acceptable in the Mackey.
No, I was talking about whether a hearing is required.
Yes, and the hearing was not something that was requested except during the oral argument itself. The judge prompted the question and said, well, don't you want a hearing or something? And the lawyer said, of course. You know, it was an afterthought. There was no request for discovery. There was no request for cross-examination. And I submit and the judge made the point, and I realized my red light's on, so I will...
You may continue.
The judge made the point that the league doesn't challenge that the law is being violated. The league doesn't challenge, virtually concedes that this is a per se violation of the antitrust law. So that's one of the findings that required. That's indisputable. Is there a reparable injury? The league wasn't really challenging that the facts that were presented to the district court with respect to the damages that are being done every single day to the players. And the court evaluated all of those conditions, set forth findings. I submit that there is no real significant disputable fact with respect to any of those things were found. The league says now that, well, we have some question about the interpretation of the provision in the collective bargaining agreement about the six-month provision and so forth. We submit that's a question of law, and there was the vote taken both before and after the end of the period of time when the collective bargaining ended. I would close simply by saying that this is a situation where the players are simply asking that the National Football League, which is a recidivist as far as the antitrust laws are concerned, stop violating the antitrust laws until the judge below has an opportunity, and it won't take a long time because much of the evidence is already there, to render a final decision with respect to the provision, the case that's before her. We're asking for a preliminary injunction for the short period of time that will not harm the NFL. The Supreme Court said in the American Needle case, you don't need protection from the antitrust laws to operate professional football. The only real claim of damage that was made was that they would lose their leverage, the leverage that stems from violating the antitrust laws. And we're simply asking that the laws of the United States be respected until there can be a decision on the merits in this case. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Olson. Does Mr. Clement have additional time?
He does, Your Honor. He has 3.5 minutes.
Okay. In fairness to Mr. Clement and his clients, add to his time the amount that Lawyer Olson went over his time with our permission. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Let me just start, Judge Benton, with your point about the six-month agreement, and let me just underscore why that can only be a minimum and not a maximum. And that's by reference to the terms of the provision at issue, because in the very provision, 3A, that has the six-month period in it where there's to be no antitrust litigation at all, the last line is, at that time, i.e. after 6 months, the parties reserve any arguments they may make regarding the application of the labor exemption. So it's clear from the text of the six-month agreement that that was a minimum, not a maximum, and there would still be arguments about the continuing application of the labor exemption at that time. Now, let me make a few other points specifically in rebuttal. First of all, Mr. Olson conceded, as I think he had to, that there are some provisions in the Norris-LaGuardia Act that do apply in the absence of the union. The problem with that concession for his client is that the one term that appears throughout the Norris-LaGuardia Act is labor dispute, and it's broadly defined. And I would submit that it just doesn't work to say that certain provisions of the Norris-LaGuardia Act don't require a union and others do, because labor dispute, the key term that appears, it appears in Section 1, it appears in Section 4, it appears in Section 7, it is defined as broadly as one can imagine in terms that clearly do not include or require a labor union. The second point I would make, Your Honor, is Mr. Olson has argued extensively about his trio of LMRA cases, the D'Arroyo case, the Ninth Circuit case, and the Seventh Circuit case. And really, I think, you know, that those are the centerpiece of his argument, if I may say so. There are reasons why those decisions should not apply here. In the first place, they are decisions where the courts are trying to reconcile the LMRA, Section 301, a later enacted statute, with the provisions of the Norris-LaGuardia Act. We know there has to be some reconciliation of those two provisions because the Supreme Court said so in the Boys Market case. And it's not much of an extension of Boys Markets to say that, oh, well, you know, if you have an arbitration and there's a reinstatement order, that's got to be allowed to happen. The statements about Section 4, none of those cases, as Judge Colleton pointed out, involve lockouts. So the statements about Section 4 are the purest of dictum. Here's why that dictum cannot be binding. First of all, it wasn't viewed as binding by the Seventh Circuit, apparently, because in the Chicago Midtown Milk Distributors case, they said that the Norris-LaGuardia Act protected a lockout and reversed the district court. So we know it didn't bind even the Seventh Circuit. There's an even better reason it can't bind the Eighth Circuit, and that's the Brookstone-Firestone case we cite in our reply brief, because that was a recognition by this court that the Norris-LaGuardia Act protected employers. This court held both that the Norris-LaGuardia Act protected employers, that there was a essentially coextensive Boys Market exemption for employers, and that the district court's injunction in that case was improper. So it doesn't work to argue in this circuit that employers are not protected by the Norris LaGuardia Act.
I'm not sure that's his argument. I think his argument is they're not protected by 4A, not by Section 7.
Well, but all the wonderful dictum he's talking about is all about, and it's not limited to 4A. It's not really focused much on 4A. It's all wonderful dictum about the Norris LaGuardia Act and how it was designed to protect only employees. And if you take a step back, I mean, the text doesn't support that. But in terms of the legislative history, there's some support for that because Section 20 of the Clayton Act clearly is even-handed, to use this court's term, and protects employers and employees. So what's the problem in the wake of the Clayton Act? Is it that the courts are being pro-management or is it they're being pro-union? Well, they're being pro-management. So some of the spirit behind the Norris LaGuardia Act is to reinforce the Section 20 of the Clayton Act to make sure that the policies of both acts continue to protect both employers, but they weren't the problem, and employees, which was the problem. So both Section 20 and, with respect, the Norris LaGuardia Act, including Section 4, are clearly designed to protect employers and employees. The terms of 4A clearly admit of protecting employee conduct. They are mirrored on a provision of the Section 20, which clearly protected both employees and employers. And as I say, if you go with the dictum in the First Circuit, the Ninth Circuit, and the Seventh Circuit, you're running squarely into your own precedents. If you're going to rely on any dictum from out-of-circuit cases, I suggest a place to look is Judge Winner's decision in the NBA against Williams case and Judge Edwards' decision picking up that language in the Brown case. They make the point that lockouts are covered. And, of course, if any more evidence were needed that lockouts are covered by the Norris LaGuardia Act, it comes from the LMRA's provision that gives the president emergency authority to overcome the two things that you can't enjoin under the Norris LaGuardia Act, strikes and lockouts by terms. So certainly the Congress that passed the LMRA thought that lockouts were covered by the Norris LaGuardia Act.
Could you talk about Section 7 as part of your list there and say what a hearing would be about if we got to Section 7 and there needed to be a hearing?
I'd be delighted to, Your Honor. I think if we had a hearing, there would be lots of things that would be disputed, including the factors that go to irreparable injury, which we very much dispute. But also, I think it would give us a vehicle to actually get into the validity of the disclaimer, which is part and parcel of whether there's any liability here. And we would be able to put forth a great deal of evidence that the disclaimer here is not a valid disclaimer. I did want to also make a point about both the relationship between the Norris LaGuardia Act and the non-statutory labor exemption and the Brown case. You're absolutely right, Judge Colleton, that the court in Brown talked about distance and time and circumstances. Now, two things are important. They talked about them as separate requirements, distance in time, distance in circumstances. They were dealing with the prior case where there was a full 2 years between the expiration of the collective bargaining agreement and the point at which the union disclaimed. So there, they didn't sort of have to worry about this prospect of an immediate disclaimer, the light switch that we've talked about in our briefs. And I think in the context of that, you don't even have to get to sort of decertification because you just can't have multi-employer bargaining that works in a situation where one side can throw a light switch and say, gotcha, all of that multi-employer conduct, all of that joint conduct that used to be fully protected by the labor law, that's now an antitrust violation. It can't work that way. And so the only thing I will say just to finish, if I could, is that the way that the laws tell you to get football back on the field is to get antitrust law and antitrust injunctions out of the field. The way to preserve labor peace is to get those antitrust considerations out of a dispute about the terms and conditions of employment. We'd respectfully request that the injunction be reversed.
Mr. Clement, I have a question on that issue about irreparable harm. Will you concede that at the present time the players are suffering irreparable harm by not being able to work out, meet the coaches? There's even a situation here where there's a rookie symposium was canceled because of this. Seems to me that that's kind of elementary to get used to the system that you're working with. What's your take on that?
Well, Your Honor, I would not concede that. And if there were an evidentiary hearing, we'd very much like to get into that discussion. And it may be that there's slight differences among certain classes of players. But, you know, we also have reports that come in, you know, virtually on a daily basis where players are saying, this is the best thing that's ever happened to me. I'm enjoying my summer. I've had more time with my family than I've ever had before. So that's the kind of stuff. I'm just here to say I wouldn't concede this. I would want to have an evidentiary hearing where you could actually get some of that evidence and get a fair consideration of whether what's happening is irreparable injury. You know, there are a couple of well-known NFL players who seem to manage to come up with some reason every offseason.
Well, the owners have loose comments too, Mr. Clement.
Then that's fine. And that's the kind of thing an evidentiary hearing could get into. I would submit, though, an evidentiary hearing is not necessary because Section 4 clearly prohibits an injunction of a lockout.
You're talking, obviously, about players who haven't met in recent days with their bankers when it comes to something called mortgages, right?
Well, but that's different from, I mean, that's not irreparable harm. That's classic reparable harm. And to the extent that people are getting more and more interested in negotiating a compromise and getting people back on the field because they've missed a couple of paychecks, that's exactly why the labor laws give you the tool of a lockout.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That will conclude the oral arguments today. I will have to say that the case has been exceptionally well briefed and well presented in court here. The issues are complex, as they should be, and you're all to be recognized for the good work you do. And I'm not talking about just the participants in the argument today. I'm talking about the Football Bar Association that sits right behind you as well. We welcome you all. We will take this case and render a decision in due course. We won't, I might also say, be all that hurt that you're leaving us out if you should go out and settle the case. But that's up to you. But we will keep with our business, and if that ends up with a decision, it's probably something both sides are not going to like, but at least will be a decision. With that, we will conclude today's case, and thank you very much for your attendance. Court stands in recess now until a week from Monday.